I still have the list of Indigenous people's representatives that were okay
with data,
with having a database, right? I still have the list in my head. Yeah. I'm not gonna say it out loud, but
I know one.
Yeah, well, there was a meeting and Bond. They said, no, why not?
This is the Go Maluku podcast.
My friends, welcome. New episode of Go Maluku podcast over here at COP28. We are, well, where are you at? Day number 7 of COP28, daily debrief number 4, I guess, which covers daily, the days 6 and 7 of COP28. Because we're not doing a daily debrief, not anymore, but it's just like, well, it's too, we're just too, yesterday we were too tired, at least I was too tired to be able to like, say anything that is useful, valuable.
What makes this COP more tired than the one before? I mean, we used to have to do this like a daily debrief. It's hot.
It's hot.
It's a heat.
It's a heat.
Yeah.
There's a lot of mileage. Like you have to do a lot of walking.
Yeah.
So for example, like the previous daily debriefs were just at a picnic benches, which is all the way across the venue.
Right. Right.
To get from there to this place B6 where we are right now, near the IPO office.
Yeah.
That is at least a 15 to 20 minute walk.
Yeah.
When it's not freaking hot. If it is hot, then you're sweating, tired before you get here.
It's been quite consistent, the temperature. I mean, somewhere between 29 to 31 degrees all day. Now it's pretty chill. But it does make a lot of difference. I mean, I've been walking, I had my Strava on today, and I've been walking about seven and a half kilometers already from the moment I hopped off the metro.
Right.
And it just goes on to show, there are more people at this COP.
How many people are at this COP?
10,000.
10,000.
No.
70,000.
100,000.
100,000?
100,000. Registered participants.
Right. Okay.
Not everybody shows up at the same time, but it's definitely more, the biggest COP ever held.
100,000 registered, so probably at any given moment, there are 70,000 people over here.
Yeah, around about that, yeah.
Yeah. So this place is massive.
Yeah.
Expo City is... I think we are at some point, this is what I've been thinking about today actually. Usually we do like a tour of COP.
Yeah, we'll do that, yeah.
But like, that would be like a 1 hour video to be able to like
do that. It takes me 20 minutes to get from here to the constituency meeting right across to building one, B1, building one.
Yeah.
And that's just,
But this is one part of this whole.
Right, and there's green zone.
Please, there's a green zone.
And there's more over there.
Right, and there's more over there.
Yeah.
And also, and then not even talk about action, climate action hub, or whatever they want you call it. So it's, massive.
Welcome to Dubai, right? Everything's massive.
Bigger.
Bigger, taller. Well, not taller
better?
Here.
Is it better?
Better? Compared to last year, I would say it's much better.
Last year, Egypt.
Yeah, no offense, but,
Right.
But obviously, being held in a place like Dubai, you see a lot of, space, Like, we are at the furthest corner of the city, right? Like outskirts, like edge of the outskirts.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
And there's plenty of space and therefore they can afford to have a big space like this compared to say, Glasgow or Madrid or
Also they haven't even finished building.
Right.
Like there's so many projects ongoing here in Dubai. Like it's when you make your way from your hotel where you at or where I'm at.
Yeah.
Towards there's so many projects ongoing.
They're always building something.
Right.
I mean, every city is building something, but this is like a different building something.
Right.
Whatever that may be, it's going to be huge. It's going to be big. Oh, big and huge, same thing, but it's going to be, it's one of those grand projects.
Like the Burj Khalifa, it's like the tallest building in the world, I assume.
Yeah.
And is that enough to the Emirati? Is that enough to Dubai?
Right.
Absolutely not.
Like they thought the Dubai airport was small, even though it's one of the biggest airports in the world.
Right.
And they're building another one, which is just outskirts.
On the other side of Dubai.
Yeah.
Just because, yeah, they
just
feel
because,
like it.
Just because.
Just because. You know, and then there's in Dubai Creek, they're now building, which is going to be like a 1.8 kilometer high building.
Yeah, okay. Like it's pretty tall.
1.6.
Yeah.
So, and then just by comparison, Burj Khalifa is like 800 meters, something along those lines.
Right.
So it's like almost double.
Yeah.
So they're just building it because they feel like it. Yeah. They create, the Dutch were good in creating land from the sea, and these people are
like building dikes and keeping things above water. But here these, it's like for the sky, like aiming for the moon.
Yeah. And then you have the palm one and the other one is bigger.
Yeah.
And then you have like entire like map of the world.
Island. Yeah.
It's insane. Like I don't know what is next. It makes you wonder, right? What is next? But this is just Dubai.
Yeah.
Not even talking about Abu Dhabi or any other of these other five Emirates. Emirati.
So I guess the idea is that, you know, there's so much going on, so many people, big space, and all of these kind of contributes to this fatigue that we often feel, but a little bit magnified at COP. And you know, right now I just feel quite empty. I don't know, like there's empty,
not soulless, but it's like
you know, every COP there's a wave, for me at least, you know. And and you start off high, and then you do things that you feel like it's meaningful and it's contributing, and it's actually driving the influence of the indigenous peoples to the negotiators and other people that would make impact in negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, but you do have this low where you feel like there's nothing going on, you know, like there's nothing you can do feeling, and just kind of sitting around and just kind of go off the rhythm. And
then
once I go off the rhythm, I feel quite hard to kind of get back on again.
All right. Is it just a question? Because it's when there's like, let's call it quiet time, you know, like nothing is happening.
Yeah.
It's not that, at least for me, it's not that I feel a crash or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's more like, shit, I should be somewhere.
Right.
So you check the schedule, CCTV, like, all right, something's wrong. Like I should be in some kind of a meeting, some kind of bilateral, some kind of negotiation, whatever.
But for me, it's like, I want to be somewhere, you know, like it's the state of stillness, state of like calmness, state of like stasis, just standing and not knowing what I'm doing. It's a feeling that you don't want at COP. I mean, even if you're new here and feel confused and you don't know what to do, I think it's one of the worst feelings you can have here.
Is it? Like, so this is something that I've been thinking about.
Yeah.
You know, like, so that feeling of inaction that you have at some point is the only way that I can compare it with is like if when someone that is your family, loved one, whatever, there's something's wrong.
Yeah.
Like he or she is sick.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know? And then you want to do everything that's humanly possible to console or remedy,
right.
And I think that's what's going on. Like, so I think, oh, sorry, no, let me rephrase that.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of sensation that you have in terms of world is sick, climate change, everything
else?
Yeah. We're here 2 weeks, can do as much as possible. Yeah. Is that it? Could that be it?
It's like, I use a hospital metaphor, you know,
explain it.
So like, you know, say my mom is sick and she has cancer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Outside the operation room, I can do a lot to help her, talk to her and give her food and play games.
Right.
But once she's in the operation room, which is, let's say, like negotiation, right?
Yeah.
And then you're kind of waiting in the waiting room, right?
Right.
And helpless. And then you always want to do something, but you can't. And that feeling perhaps not that extreme, but it's this feeling, you know? For example, Article 6.4. First day, we had a contact group, and they said there are some concerns. And we got some information about, okay, we have a bit of a divergence here. so we can work on it. But for 3 days, you know, we didn't really hear much about
the
development. And this is the feeling, like, you know, like they go back to, the states go back and do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we are kind of like feeling left without a lot of information and a lot of updates mm-hmm. on what's going on. It's like a doctor operating and when a doctor comes out, it's like, oh, like, what's going on, you know?
Right. Yeah,
but
yeah.
But until then, this time, it feels like, you know, what am I supposed to do? What
powerless.
What can I do to make it better? You know,
right. Even though you know,
yeah,
that it's out of your hands.
Right.
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 That it's let the in your metaphor in your, analogy is like let the doctor or the surgeon do their thing.
Yeah.
And then you have to like wait until the surgeon comes back. Like all
right.
It gives you like the. I don't know, like an update. Yeah. Something
it's like
that.
If you try to get into the surgical room, someone will push you out. Like, no, sorry, you cannot be here.
Right. Yeah.
Like you got to get out.
Okay.
And, you know.
Yeah. So yeah. So it's a lot of waiting.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a lot of waiting, and there are times when you can actually do something, right? Intel gathering. You know, like it's like going to Wikipedia and reading about cancer. Like that's that's the metaphor. Right?
Okay. Yeah. Today's like nowadays it's ChatGPT.
Or like going in WhatsApp group and trying to get a piece of something that could make me feel like I'm actually developing my understanding of what's going on.
Right. But aren't you like, so you're trying to, what's the right word? Keep yourself occupied. Is that what it is?
Well, there's a rhythm. Right.
Right.
There's a rhythm in the whole kind of COP experience.
Right.
Right. It's supposed to intensify as you go along.
Yeah.
But this COP, it's been a lot of up and down. Like it's like this.
Okay.
And every COP is different, but this one I particularly felt at least these days quite. Yeah, there are times when I feel like I don't have enough legs to do all the work.
Okay.
And then there are times I just feel like, you know, give me something.
Right.
Yeah.
And what do you do when you're like, all right, give me something. So what generally what you do is, do you like go to the office, like close your eyes and like, you know what, I'm going to sleep for a couple hours? Or what is it that...
No, I mean, I spend an awful lot of time in the office these days. You know, just sitting in. And there are always people.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes I find myself talking to these people.
Right.
And those are kind of unrelated to the negotiation themselves. Or just looking at the online platform and see if there's anything interesting going on.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I just go to the, you know, I'm like, you know what? I just don't want to be here anymore. So I'm going to walk 20 minutes to get to the human rights and climate change group across the street, even though like, yeah, maybe I'm not going to get much out of there, but I'm still going to go anyway, because I just don't want to stop. I just don't want to be in that situation where I'm completely.
FOMO?
No, it's not FOMO. I just don't want to be in a situation where I'm just doing nothing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Tell me the difference between the online platform, so you can like catch the negotiation on Article 6 versus being in the room.
Well,
is there an added benefit, pros and cons?
Well, let's face it, right? Online platform. If I use online platform, I can listen in to the negotiation from any parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
right? Of course, the benefit of that is sometimes you get the clarity of what the negotiators are saying, because when you're in the room, the sound kind of echoes a little bit, and sometimes things get lost. And if you don't have a table in front of you, you're kind of writing on your knees, right? So the room is always crowded. So it's really hard for one to concentrate and keep consistent focus on the negotiation dynamic.
Right.
Of course, today, like day like today, another thing, there's a technical problem. And oftentimes things freeze, and then I just threw a pen at my computer screen this morning because you know someone was making a very important intervention. I wanted to hear it, but then the hourglass appeared in front of my face.
Right.
And that was the moment I actually realized, in person is much superior. But you know, I've been in many in-person negotiations before.
Yeah.
And And obviously, depending on the format, you can actually see a lot of what the negotiations are, negotiators are kind of, the dynamic. Because there's some plus alpha factor that you cannot pick up just by looking at the virtual platform.
Because
virtual platform only show you the person's face,
okay,
right? And you don't get to see the dynamic of the atmosphere, the people's reaction, people's emotion to what other people, what that specific person is saying.
Right.
And of course, we had this situation in the first day when I was observing the negotiation in the virtual platform, but the chair of the meeting gave observers time to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and then there were no indigenous observer who can or who are there and willing to speak.
Yeah.
There, so that's. You know, and I think there was a missed, that's a big missed opportunity,
okay,
I would say. So the presence in the room is always crucial, regardless of whether there is an offering of the virtual platform or not.
Right, Well, in addition, I always prefer like being in the room. Like, I don't care if they web stream or webcast like 4K or 8K, whatever, Dolby Surround, like it's, like you said, you know, the camera focuses on a speaker and you only see that.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm much more interested in seeing how other people respond.
Yeah.
And you don't see that from your, even though you have like a 43-inch TV or whatever, like monitor, you don't see that.
Yeah.
And particularly, like, unfortunately, like the setup in these negotiations is like school classroom format, you know, like rows and rows. So you do not see people's facial expressions, especially when you're like in as an observer, like all the way in the back, and you only look at people's, you know, the back of their heads and their shoulders, you know, so you only see that. However, and if it's like if in a circle format, like in
absolutely,
it's if in one of those rooms, like meeting room four, you know, and some of these other rooms, you can actually see people's facial expressions. And like, I had this conversation today with some youth reps about like, all right, how do I prepare for negotiation and everything else? And then and one of the things that I said was like, when, let's say you're talking, and I'm observing, then I don't need to talk to you. Like, I know that you're talking. And also like, it is much more interesting to like, whilst you're talking, like, all right, how is Chile responding to what you're saying?
Yeah.
How is Norway responding?
Yeah.
Or is there a response from Japan?
Yeah.
Verbal, visual, body language, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That is so much more interesting to me.
Yeah.
That it also like, it's part of the, kind of like the profile that you have of persons, parties that might not be like a deciding factor, but it helps you, or helps me at least. All right, you said something, and at that point, Chile was like very uncomfortable, or Peru looked at you like in total disgust. So that registers with me, because that to give you a very very a good example, like last night when they went like overtime on so many negotiating streams, including agriculture, and that was one of those like those rooms where they sat in like a square format, and one of the G77 plus China reps, can't remember which country that was speaking, and so everyone was looking at in that direction, but like it's not interesting because I know that that person is speaking, so you look at the other. At the other direction, and then you see like some other countries like, what the hell is he talking about? Like this. So that's interesting to me, to know what the, even though I don't track agriculture, but to know a little bit the dynamics, landscape, and all those things. So that's one of the reasons why it's for me at least like it's, in person trumps, virtual.
I guess, there is also two examples that I have in my head that would probably support your argument. One was the transitionary committee. in Abu Dhabi last month.
Right.
And this whole movement of people that you don't see on the video, right? So you see the speaker, but behind speakers there are so many delegates who are kind of moving from one place to another. Maybe one party's heading over to another party, negotiating and talking, and then you kind of wonder, and then you have more context around. Okay, so this statement was made, and all of a sudden, the room started to move. But you don't really see that in the virtual. And another example is when we're in Sharm. Mm-hmm. We had a negotiation at 2:30 in the morning.
Right.
And there were many delegates who weren't paying attention because they are human. And at the same time, they are also very, very exhausted and tired. And at that time, we were there to see it. But when some statements are being made, which are of concern to, indigenous peoples and civil societies, mm-hmm. and then you look around the room and everybody's not taking any notes or reacting to it, right. I say. Then being in a room allows some of us take action.
Right.
Whereas virtual, then you have nothing, you can do nothing about it.
Describe to me then, all right, let's say that we agree that there's added benefit in, there's more benefit in being in a room, obviously.
Yeah.
However, you can also be in a room and just paying attention, but when something like that happens, that you described, what was tell me the steps that you went through from the observation, they talk about rights of indigenous people, for example, you see them doze off, and what is the process that you go through, get up, go to them. Yeah. And what do you say?
So we had a team of three people, and it was actually four, and then you went. You decided to.
I decided I had to go.
Yeah, you had to go.
You had to go.
You tried your best to delay your flight, but that
wasn't possible. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah, our task given our task before us that was given by you was very clear. Defend the paragraph. Which references human rights. I don't know if it referenced rights of indigenous people, but it definitely referenced human rights or some kind of safeguard language. And we were there to defend it until the end of the consultation, at least. So what happened was around 2:30, 3 a.m. in the morning, there was an intervention. And I won't say which country it was, but there was an intervention from one country that decided to kind of challenge this paragraph to be deleted. And we heard it. So my assumption was, well, that should kind of provoke some kind of response, mm-hmm. or emotion,
right.
Writing something.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen, and the speaker's list kind of continued.
Yeah.
So I tapped on, at that time it was Ronaldo's shoulder, and says, okay, there was no reaction from the parties that would ordinarily defend this particular paragraph. So I said, okay, let's check who's in the room, mm-hmm. right? So we did the inventory check. EU was there, ILAC was there, who else was there? Norway was there,
EIG
was there.
Yeah.
AOSIS was there. So I'm not a particularly a kind of guy with a nerve to walk up to the delegates, but we had Ronaldo, who was who's very much good at this stuff.
Okay.
So I asked Ronaldo, hey, can you go around the room to just to make sure that they heard the intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Not that reiterate the position, but they heard.
Right.
And then they understand what this particular country was objecting to.
Yeah.
So Renato was like, sure, he would go around the room, and then he reported back and told me that, they were kind of like they were one of them was not paying attention, And then once that happened, actually, I don't think any party members in the room realized that there were observers sitting in the negotiation.
Up until that moment.
Up until that moment.
Right.
And maybe, I would say, we were kind of like, well, were we actually allowed to go around the room and talk to the parties? But that's perhaps another question. But we had the opportunity, so we did it. And then we started to hear interventions led by the EU. And then obviously I think the EU understood that we have actually communicated concerns evenly across the parties which would defend this particular paragraph. So number of interventions followed that have indeed highlighted, you know, we support the EU's comment on this particular paragraph.
Right, because like if we do not say anything, then the co-chairs in this case assume that it's fine. Like silence is fine.
It's consensus.
It's so consensus.
If there's no objection, then they would assume that.
So you want them to push back. So you go around the room, like, hey, by the way, wake up. Like this is what's being said.
Yeah.
And it's fine, by the way, like it's like 2 a.m. in the morning, everyone is.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't say like, oh, why didn't you? But you know, we just went in and says, did you register the intervention that's
so
been
the
made?
Quorum is also like super important.
Yeah.
It's not like, hey, idiot, like this, but you.
Yeah, we were kind of very discreet about it, right? Like we just
diplomatic, I would say.
Diplomatic, yeah.
Okay.
And then I think that they all knew the position of indigenous peoples, right?
Yeah.
But Renato came back later and said, oh, one of the parties just told me to get lost, you know. But that's part of what happens.
That happens.
He doesn't take it. I mean, he's a very, you know.
No, but like, it's also like a volume game, you know. There's so many parties around the table. You go to the parties that you know
very
well first. It's a numbers game. You try to approach as many parties as possible. And like just wait for the one to take the floor to push back. And maybe that will trigger other parties to say something about that as well. So I'm asking I just want to highlight the importance of being in a room even when Dubai is awesome. You go to Burj Khalifa and Burj Al Arab and Dubai Mall and whatnot. Whereas negotiations are ongoing. And the last thing that, no, not the last thing, something that bugs me is always that, negotiations are ongoing and you say you sign up for a work stream.
Yeah.
But when negotiations are going, even when they go like beyond 8 p.m., 10 p.m., you're not in the room.
Yeah. And this is where I think a lot about, you know, what is the responsibility of observers, right, at the COP? What is the responsibility upon us on behalf of the civil society to do here?
Right.
And so when I was in this room, which was deciding a very important, the very core of the Paris Agreement, the carbon market. I mean, I don't want to say core, but one of the fundamental pieces of Paris Agreement, carbon market. And I was just astonished that in that meeting, there was only four of us.
Right.
And then we felt like, oh my God, you know, like.
It
all comes down to this.
Yeah.
And then just remember how many observers have signed up for this COP.
Right.
And they're asking for better participation. They're asking for more spaces for observers to observe. Yet, when you get to the most important, critical segment of negotiations, where are they?
Yeah, so that is one of my, that's like one of the elements of my main concerns when it comes to participation of Indigenous peoples in these spaces is that like we ask for everything. When we go into negotiations, like participation, Article 18, everything else, like it's a talking point.
Yeah.
Like it's a continuing talking point. The one thing that I always start instilling people is that, with right comes responsibility.
Yeah.
And also, like, if you have the right to participate in decision-making processes that affect you, and you are able to participate, then you should be participating.
Yeah.
And Yeah, nobody likes these late night negotiations till 10 p.m., midnight, or 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And I can assure you that will happen in the second week.
Oh, yeah. It could just happen.
Negotiations.
It could even happen tonight. You never know.
Well, it happened last night.
It happened last night.
Yeah. We went here until midnight. And, you know, the crazy thing is that, like, and it's totally not CSO perspective, but definitely the indigenous people. Yeah. So, like, all right, Article 6, well, we know we want 6.2, 6.4, 6.8. But then, you know, like I look at the CCTV like, oh, agriculture is still ongoing.
Yeah, stock take still going.
Stock take is still ongoing. So I check in, and then I see like, all right, yeah, the two indigenous youth reps from Latin America are still here.
Yeah, and kudos to them, by the way, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's keeping the pressure on.
Yeah.
Because keeping the pressure on is not just through words and bilaterals, but actually like showing your face in those meeting rooms and, you know, like telling them like, hey, we're here.
Yeah.
You know, like, and if there's something happens that we don't like, we'll walk up to you.
Yeah.
And the flip side of it is also like, if something happens that we like, we'll walk up to you, like I said, like, hey, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, like, and those are things actually, because you need to, one is to like to put pressure on them, but also encourage them.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's something that is kind of like bugging me is that first day COP, and this is every year when I went to COP. First day COP, everyone signs up for a working group, work stream, very ambitious.
Yeah.
But then, like the first meeting happens and you already see like, all right, people dropping off.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to like late night negotiations, and then like sometimes like I text people like, all right, hey, contact group starts at 8. Anyone available? Oh no, sorry, I'm not at COP anymore. Or I'm already at the hotel.
Yeah.
And like, okay. You know, like it's, the thing is that this is like a peak moment. Like this is like over at COP for 2 weeks. It is actually very important that we do excel, that we do keep the pressure on, and that we do keep looking them in the faces or standing in the face and say like, hey, doesn't matter whether it's 8 a.m. or 8 p.m., we're here. And that is something that I would like to see more. A lot more.
And I like to think, you say right is a responsibility, the right comes with responsibility.
Absolutely.
I agree with that. And my way of putting it is like with right comes practice. As in, if you don't practice it, then it'll be taken away.
Right.
You know, if we don't practice the right to be in the room at 2 o'clock in the morning, well, the secretariat's just gonna sign a smaller room. Oh, we don't need a bigger room. We thought the observer will show up, but they didn't.
Right.
So we're gonna just pack everybody in a small room. And then if we do decide to practice it later, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, the room is full.
Yeah.
Or you know what, late night, the observer's not gonna be around anyway, so we might as well call the meeting like a closed meeting.
Yeah, so same thing with these people's right to self-determination. Yeah. Like, you don't ask for it, you claim it.
Right.
You know, and that is something that it still hasn't instilled in people, I think.
Yeah.
It's in a way that I wanted to see in the negotiations. It's like, well, hey, self-determination is something that you claim. So you show up to those meetings.
Yeah.
You...
any rights, right? Like you even human rights.
It's always like when it comes to sovereignty, self-determination, like people talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, like there's like, yeah, we have the right to sovereignty and self-determination. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
Like I'm one of the proponents of that.
Yeah.
However, it's not something that you only claim when it suits you. Mm. Like it's so when it comes to these negotiations, you do show up.
Yeah.
It takes a long time, it takes a while or it goes well into the night, but hey, you know, like you sign up for this.
But you know, you also represent you also work at the pledge of the caucus, and you represent them in a various capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
As the Article 6 head leads. So not only the self-determination of your nation, but self-determination of all, like, you know, peoples, or, right. or the peoples who are represented in this caucus. So yeah. it's so there's more than that, you know, like you have to think about everybody, everyone who show up, and they all have their demands and wishes, and you can't just work for yourself in a way,
or
for your nation. I mean, you try to, but at the same time, you have to think about all other kind of.
Yeah, because like my context, for example, yeah. it's not contacts, but the context
yeah.
is different than the context of Indigenous peoples living in North America or in Latin America, sure, or wherever, sure, you know? So sure. it's not that. So one thing that a lot of people need to know is that, like, so when you're in a, definitely when you're in the international level, yeah. let alone if you're yeah. leading or yeah. in the leadership position, whatever, yeah. you know, like you need to find that balance.
Yeah.
Like the last yeah. thing you should be doing, like, all right, this is what I think.
Yeah.
And everyone else, yeah. like, fuck you, and yeah. And yeah. Like, you all need yeah. to do what I want
yeah.
you to do.
Yeah.
No, it's the opposite of it. Yeah. It's like, all right, like you got to balance it out. Like, what are your views? What yeah. are your views? What are your yeah. views? All right. So what is the common denominator? What is the middle ground
yeah.
that we can carry it forward? That yeah. everyone can recognize
yeah.
themselves
yeah.
in the strategy or in the position that we do. For example, yeah. so it's also, you know, for example, one of the great examples that this caucus meeting that we had this morning, separation of local communities and Indigenous peoples. Yeah. You know, it's as clear as it can get.
Yeah.
You know, like it's the caucus wants it.
Yeah.
You know, and like. People keep dancing yeah. around the issue.
Yeah.
And some people.
Yeah.
But it's clear that this is what the caucus wants because yeah. it recognizes the dangers
yeah.
of the conflation of Indigenous yeah. peoples and local communities. Yeah. And then it is okay. Like there's some reference to local knowledge systems in the Paris
yeah.
Agreement.
Yeah.
There is something going on
yeah.
over there at the CBD.
Yeah.
However, you know, like you do see the danger.
Yeah.
And like keeping sticking to the letter of the law, for example, the Paris Agreement, yeah, try to do as much as possible. But also post-Paris, we did start to capitalize INP of Indigenous peoples. And also there are things that are necessary
yeah.
to push for, to improve.
Yeah.
Because if not,
yeah.
then it will usurp or water down the existing rights that we already
yeah.
have.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like the core of what I'm trying to get to is the mandate.
Yeah.
You know, like, so the caucus decides. The caucus is pretty much unanimous about like that this needs yeah. to happen, but yeah. it's there's still like resistance
yeah.
from a few yeah. to push this.
Yeah.
To push this forward in the way that the caucus wants this.
Yeah.
So that is one of the things that I'm concerned with.
I feel like it's a discussion that also requires, I mean, you know, we clearly heard today that, you know, enough time has been spent on this, right?
Yeah.
Something has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, caucus is also a space where I guess you have people new to the discussion coming in. So of course there has to be some time to discuss it in the caucus, but obviously there are so many other things that's going on during the day that makes it very difficult
right.
to kind of utilize that time to discuss something as important as this.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so we're starting to. But the reality is that this language of, say, Indigenous and local knowledge is coming up in different work streams within the Paris Agreement, from
yeah.
global golden adaptation to
6.8. GST
and
agriculture. Yeah,
and obviously, it's hard to determine what is the source of this particular issue.
Who pushed it?
Yeah, who pushed yeah. it? But at the same time, it's also a result of perhaps the people who are responsible in looking after these different work streams have noted, but haven't really reacted to it.
Right.
So now, like, we're at a situation where you know, yesterday, for example, we started covering different topic,
yeah.
right? So but how does it work? Because first of all, like, you're supposed to focus on Article 6, right?
Yeah.
That's what the caucus has mandated you to do.
Bestowed upon me. Yeah.
but then now, like, people come and go. Some people might have already left. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But someone has to kind of, you know, has to address this issue. But you don't have the caucus mandate to say go into global someone else's kind of turf, basically.
Yeah.
But again, like I said, it's not very working out very well in terms of coordination and advocacy.
No.
So what's your kind of, you know, next few days, right? This is crucial. How are you going to kind of report to the caucus, or how are you going to try to kind of get the people to understand, like, this is a big issue, because if you don't do anything about it, then it'll stay,
right?
It'll get adopted, and at some other places in some other time, they're going to use this language.
Exactly, because, like, it's so right now how it is written is like indigenous knowledge and local knowledge,
yeah,
and it's trying to mirror indigenous peoples and local communities,
right?
So first of all, like, when it comes to just the way I see it right now, like, it's fine if you talk about knowledge.
Yeah.
The problem is when you talk about rights,
yeah,
then there needs to be a comma or and as appropriate, all that stuff. Legalese.
Yeah.
But you do see as of late, and I mean as of late, like this COP, that when it comes to indigenous knowledge, they, like, there's also local knowledge.
Yeah.
The question is, like, what in the world is local knowledge?
Right.
And also, like, I understand local communities if it's within the spirit of the convention of the CBD.
Yeah.
Like, in these local communities embodying traditional lifestyles for conservation of blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Right? That is clear.
Yeah.
But so they're trying to abbreviate or, like, make it short to local communities.
Yeah.
All right. Still murky, but I get it.
Yeah.
Local knowledge doesn't make any sense. Like, so local knowledge, it implies that there's also global knowledge.
Right.
You know, so, and then what is it then?
Yeah.
You know?
I have a local knowledge.
Right,
About this place.
Yeah, but, like, what is then global knowledge? And where's the line between? Yeah. Anyway, that's different conversation that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. But it's not specific enough to be comfortable with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing is, the thing that I'm concerned with is that not only that, but also that it pops up everywhere.
Yeah.
It's that like I just glance over the decision text of agriculture.
Yeah.
And glancing over is like command F, indigenous.
Yeah.
All sorts of shit, local knowledge. All right. And then we agriculture adaptation, DGA. So, like, command F, local knowledge. Like, what in the world's going on? You know, so, like, the way that I addressed it is that, all right, I do it in a caucus.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course, like, I do Article 6, but then, what I did was, like, I grabbed one of the other streams and said, hey, guys, I just want to flag that this is going on.
Yeah.
Also, I do my best to inform the caucus as accurate as possible about a negotiating stream.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I don't have anything to say, I will shut up.
Yeah.
Because the last thing that I want is to make up stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And also give outdated information.
Yeah.
Because that was happening at caucus as well. Mm. You know, so the caucus was presented with information that was as accurate until 4 p.m.
Yeah.
Well, there was a contact group or a negotiation still ongoing at midnight.
Yeah.
And there was still a new iteration to be presented by the co-facilitators of the Global Stocktake.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, it is super important that when people call upon you to report, that you are able to report, or you put yourself in a position to report, but also, like, provide the information that,
or be accurate at least, right?
It's FPIC.
Yeah.
It's FPIC.
Yeah.
So, like, we cannot claim or assert FPIC externally. Mm. It will have to do it internally.
Yeah.
So, because, like, yeah, so I expect from a lead of a work stream to present me with the information that I need if there's a decision to be made, that's accurate and that is, you know, like according to the FPIC.
Yeah.
So obviously on Article 6, I cannot do that in 3 minutes during the caucus. Right. So we do coordination.
Yeah.
If you are interested, you go to coordination.
Yeah.
So the thing is that, so in caucus is what I do is like, oh, hey guys, this is what I see. This is what I see pop up. This is what I believe to be the consequence of it.
Yeah.
Hence, or ergo, we need to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
You know, like, so you never come up with a half a thing. Like, you do need to do something or present something to them. So that is a little bit the challenge, not a challenge, but something that I observed today that it actually, and I had this conversation with Dane there this afternoon from the Métis National Council, that could it be, researcher, you know, like, so maybe you have a better academic view on it, indigenous peoples, like what is, you know, so indigenous peoples, the thing that we are like, that we herald, that we are claimed to be famous for, or are famous for, is holistic view, cosmovision, like that mindset, right? Which is very good for dealing with these issues that is super siloed.
Yeah.
Agriculture, adaptation, Article 6, loss and damage, all silos, right? So you would think that we would be able to play that whole game to make sure that we have, that we jump over these silos, that we see through compartmentalization of the UNFCCC. So I'm gonna ask you, what if the tables have been turned?
Right.
So the UNFCCC or COP or CMA has figured it out.
Yeah.
How one influences the other. For example, Article 6.
Yeah.
GST,
yeah.
Loss and damage,
yeah.
Agriculture, GST, all stuff.
Yeah.
Yet indigenous peoples are still hyper focused on tunnel vision, work stream. I focus on loss and damage. I focus on agriculture.
Yeah.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
That's happening right now.
Yeah. Well, there's also another kind of way to look at it. Right, because when you look at global stocktake is basically bringing everything back together.
Yeah.
Right, so it was siloed before, just like cover decision. The stocktake is meant to bring the different work stream into one concise document. Mm-hmm. But it's still very siloed because the way it's organized is sectioned.
Right.
Right. But I think there are some things that really bothers me. Just looking at, not bothers me, but something I noticed.
Yeah.
Maybe bothers. Maybe I've already said it bothers me, but you know, noticed is that not only it's siloed now, but it's also driven by in a very simple term, money.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Because indigenous peoples also talk about, you know, you can't put money on things. You can't trade nature, because nature is intrinsic to us. It's a symbiotic relationship that really makes indigenous people's lifestyle say sustainable.
Yeah.
I feel that even if people are working for different work stream, there's always this temptation to play this game of markets and money, you know, and I think that's actually more of a growing concern for me as an observer, is that working as a silo, sometimes it helps us to organize knowledge, but that could also be very colonizing, because it's not organized in your own term. Right? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure even Japanese people will feel mitigation, adaptation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just indigenous peoples, I think. A lot of people think, why are we organizing our work in such a way?
Right.
But what's cross-cutting is the question of finance. It's the question of just general imperative of putting money on everything.
Yeah.
And that also kind of changes what is incentive here for work, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a concern that's not just shared by some indigenous peoples, but also by just general NGOs, you know, mm-hmm. looking for no market solutions, looking for, you know, really bringing the action to the community and giving them direct access to funding, or just rewarding people with good ideas, mm-hmm. right, regardless of who you are.
Yeah.
But now, not only the government game, but also finance game is set up by the people with the money, and then, yeah. and then everybody are kind of like being played to play both games, right? Like you have to play the silo game, but you also have to play the finance game.
Okay.
And when you combine those two together, what you get is a very very, you know, very very I don't know like a. Like a capitalist system where everything, even in this silo stream, has to be spoken of in relation to finance.
Yeah, but so is the natural conclusion then about all this, yeah. your observation,
yeah.
is that it is the climate change is an economy.
Well, yeah, it's a marketization.
Right.
At least that's how I feel like. I mean, we've seen that, you know, this spread of market mechanisms through different work stream of the UN,
yeah.
right? CBD and potentially even in BBNJ.
Definitely in yeah. UNFCCC.
Yeah. yeah. And UNFCCC as well. And I'm not saying that people don't need financing. I think, you know, there are a lot of projects that are worth investing in.
Right. But I think, at what cost?
Yeah, at what cost?
Right.
Again.
So what's the price on rights? What's the price yeah. on?
And this it happens in negotiation, right? Like
yeah.
like what I get in return for erasing the reference to human rights or something like that.
Right.
What I get in return for you know for something that should not have a price. That's a priceless thing.
Yeah.
The things that no matter how much people are willing to give you, you cannot trade it because it's important to you.
Supposedly.
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 Yeah.
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 But now you've seen it. There's
yeah.
wiggle room.
Yeah.
Wiggle room.
Yeah.
And some of the arguments that some people make. Constituencies,
yeah.
including some indigenous yeah. peoples, like there's wiggle room.
Yeah,
has been, I don't know, interpreted, created. Yeah.
And I think this is why I feel I share the views of Andrea. Like, no market approach is really exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are states, you know, there's one reference to carbon pricing that, like, a lot of states want to get rid of.
Yeah.
Right, and we just want that approach to be something that is in, like not innocent, but to be
noble,
free, to
noble.
Be free yeah, yeah, of pricing.
The pure intent of international cooperation.
Yeah, pure
yeah.
pure intent of international cooperation, sharing knowledge, and letting people live the lifestyle that they deem sustainable, and then let them practice their mitigation adaptation.
Yeah.
In their own way.
Right.
And I wonder, you know, maybe that's what indigenous people might have wanted, like just be left alone and do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's funding required, then of course there should be a mechanism for that. But I feel like if there is going to be a funding that comes for the non-market mechanism to support these projects.
What would you say to people? Because I heard it.
Yeah.
Because we've been talking about non-market approach
yeah.
And building in elements of just transition,
yeah, yeah.
Indigenous knowledge,
yeah.
Practices and
yeah.
ways of knowing
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
What would you say to people who say, hey, Tomo, but it's still a non-market approach.
Yeah.
So it's still a market.
Oh, right. I mean, yeah, it's so the thinking behind it mm-hmm. is very related to the market, right? Because it's still siloed between what is market and what is non-market.
Okay.
Right, so that's the frame. It's
yeah.
not like what is nature, what is technology. or what is indigenous and what is non-indigenous. Mm-hmm. It's market and no market.
Yeah.
Right? But at least no market, and I think indigenous peoples have markets, don't you think? They have markets.
We have economies.
Yeah, you have economies. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a different way.
Yeah.
Like, it's a barter system.
Yeah, barter, yeah.
Yeah, something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But there's, yeah.
Yeah, but
continue, sorry.
There's no privatization. Like, I mean, there might be.
It could be.
Yeah. But this idea of collective ownership, like collective responsibility, collective ownership.
It's a responsibility thing.
Yeah. So the resources are collectively owned.
Yeah.
I think that's part of what unites, you know, collective rights of indigenous people.
Yeah.
And being a non-market mechanism, I think, is about this collective exercise. That's how I see it. It's a practice of collective rights.
In the context of 6.8, is how I try to explain to everyone is that it's the collective realization that we need to change our lifestyle.
Yeah. A collective lifestyle.
Right.
Yeah.
That is sustainable.
Yeah.
You know, and then, the way that I see it is before, because that's the whole problem, before.
Yeah.
Parties didn't have an idea what in the world is a non-market approach.
Yeah.
They've been thinking about it for 10 years. To this day, they might have an idea, but like, there's an hesitation towards like a definition of removals.
Yeah. Because everybody wants to go through the market. Because you know.
Yeah, there's money in it. There's incentives involved. Yeah. But the thing is that non-market approach. What I would do is try to, and I think this first step has been made by having indigenous peoples not involved, but present on what the lifestyle change is, what the values are, the principles are.
Yeah.
That the first step has been made, like, hey, there's not one definition of a non-market approach.
Right.
That's another definition of a non-market approach. What I like to see and what could happen through indigenous people participating in these workshops is that you come to a whole new, you label it differently.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's labeling different things these days. Like loss and damage is now a climate impact, and
So why don't we do it as well?
Yeah.
And call it something else.
Yeah.
You know, so now there's a huge opposition to include carbon pricing. Into 6.8. Hopefully that
because they but they still see it as like it could just be a one example of what non-market approach could be. And I don't think a lot of countries want to kind of single out this particular approach, this particular activity as non-market approach, because it feels like it's limiting. So they want a much broader application of understanding of non-market approach. I think if indigenous peoples are able to smartly engage with this mechanism, there's definitely an opportunity to kind of showcase more of what the lifestyle or what indigenous peoples have been doing for the many, many years to an audience that is actually, to an audience that has power to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So I do see an opportunity for engagement. I do see a lot of, like, that's where indigenous peoples can actually exercise their right to express their culture and to demonstrate their knowledge to people that are actually excited about this. But I guess my only concern is that, you know, there has always been a talk about treating non-market approach and market approach equally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bolivia, for example, has always maintained a position that, you know, that all of the Article 6 paragraphs have to be given equal attention.
Yeah.
But the problem now is that everybody's rushing to 6.4, right? A lot of submissions, a lot of ideas, and a lot of money, and a lot of parties are kind of packed in that one space.
Yeah.
Whereas the 6.8 receives a very little kind of focus. And that concerns me a little bit. Does it mean that there's a lot of power vacuum where you know, where there is more space for stakeholders and rights holders to be engaged? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I see non-market approach is a very collective exercise, right? Because it's a lifestyle change. It requires collective engagement. Whereas the market approach is when you put price on things, and when you trade things, it's like a privatization, right? It's individuals. It's the very practice, the nature of capitalism. It destroys this idea of collective ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, it's within everybody's right to, or every community, every people's right to engage in the market if that's something for them. But there has to be some opportunity for people who don't want to engage in the market to still contributing to the goals of the Paris Agreement and be recognized for it while maintaining their way of life and ensuring that those lifestyles are recognized and protected.
Right, yeah. But the, yeah. There's also like if you another advantage that I see yeah. or advantage I won't yeah. call it advantage but yeah. a plus that I see yeah. is that the how should I if you look at the text of Article 6 is yeah. about cooperative approaches.
Yeah.
Voluntary cooperative approaches,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And if you focus on cooperative approaches amongst parties, amongst states.
Yeah.
So Article 6.8, to me, it's a super opportunity for indigenous peoples, not yeah. just Indigenous Peoples Organization, yeah. but actual Indigenous peoples,
yeah.
to exercise international cooperative approach by, you know, like by like nation to nation help, yeah, helping yeah. them, right?
Yeah. yeah.
Sorry. So that is something that I how I choose to yeah. interpret 6.8. Yeah. Others will choose it yeah. to interpret differently. Yeah. 100%, yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
But it's also about, you know, like it's trying to create avenues for Indigenous peoples, even though they're not there,
yeah.
but create avenues for Indigenous peoples to participate
yeah.
in a way that they can participate as self-determining peoples.
Yeah.
And like we've been like, If you bring it to like the fact or the statistic or the talking point, like 80% of the world's made in biodiversity, lands, territories, and indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know, like the first question to come up with a Western country would be like, all right, so what is it then?
Yeah.
You know, and then, so I want to go beyond that talking point.
Yeah, yeah.
Beyond a talking point of the 80% of the world's remaining biodiversity, yeah. beyond going yeah. to plenary yeah. statements for 2 minutes, yeah, yeah. trying to say the thing over and over and over again every time,
yeah.
but actually, go to 6.8, go to a web portal,
yeah. Yeah.
and you see actual non-market approaches of Indigenous yeah. peoples, a barter system. Yeah. If we go to, how about the Hawaiian Ahapua'a system?
Yeah.
You know, and then. You look at that as a model and you see if that has an international application
yeah,
to
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not Hawaiian, yeah. but it would be interesting if people from Hawaii could elaborate further on
yeah.
that. And then there's like a plethora of examples out there that would be interesting in this whole thing. And the thing is that I'm the first one to say that I'm against a database of traditional knowledge, 100%.
I think it's been a position. I mean, the local community, Indigenous Peoples platform, right?
Well, in the very beginning,
yeah.
the idea was, and I still have the list of Indigenous Peoples representatives
yeah.
that were okay
with data,
with having a database,
yeah.
right? I still have the list in my head.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say it out loud,
yeah.
but.
I know one.
Yeah, well, there was a meeting and Bond. They said,
yeah.
no.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know, like, we have traditional knowledge. Why don't we make money out of it?
It works for some, I imagine.
Exactly. And that is one of my main concerns is that, well, if it works for me, then it should work for everyone.
Yeah.
But that's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, so it's...
But the carbon market assumes that, right?
Well,
there's a straitjacket rules
well,
for...
Yeah, but and also, like, people yeah. that say, like, well, a database or traditional knowledge is fine because,
yeah.
well, you know, like, traditional yeah. knowledge is public yeah. Knowledge anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, that might be in your situation, but not in my situation or anybody else's situation. Yeah. So, so with the initial idea of the platform, absolutely not going to do it.
Yeah.
But like, this is a normal market approach. It's because there's so far not as much interest into it, for example, in comparison with 6.2, 6.4. People still trying to figure out what a normal market approach is like. So we can still shape that.
Yeah,
we're still in the design phase.
Yeah,
you know, and then you can bitch and moan about like how wrong UNCCC is.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of merit in that in that argument, and I would agree like 99% of it.
Yeah,
but you know there are these people that want to participate.
Yeah,
and it's up to us. That's how I see it: is to create the framework.
Yeah,
they can safely do it.
And this is where I go back to my own kind of point about with right comes practice. Grievance and appeal mechanism.
Yeah.
The parties asked, what is it? What do people want?
Right.
They have given the opportunity for stakeholders and indigenous peoples to make an input.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't use that opportunity to define, to set the tone on what the mechanism is or can be, then they're gonna create something that you don't want in the end.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, when Glasgow, it's great to be in a phase where people are asking, what is it? Right? It's like the most simplest question, the first question you ask to anyone, like, what is it? What is this?
Yeah.
Right? And this is where, same as the BBNJ, like, what is it? What is it that we're looking at? And then you are in that negotiation from the very start, correct? Mm-hmm. So, and then you are able to kind of have the seat to kind of explain.
Yeah.
And then as a result, some of the things that are in the text reflects some of your understanding of the topic.
Yeah.
So this non-market approach has been, I mean, it's been established in Paris, so it's been 8 years, but they still, you know, for better or worse, asking themselves what exactly it is that we're talking about. And I'm really happy that Andrea and the chief and Victor and others were able to kind of leave that, you know, like print in that, because it comes out as a report.
Yeah,
and that report will be basis for something else, and I think that was like that really gives me as long as indigenous peoples maintain their engagement, that gives me a lot of optimism.
It's also something because like it probably could be part of it.
Yeah,
is a lot of these things.
Yeah,
you cannot conceptualize it.
Right.
It is very hard to like put your teeth into like what is adaptation,
right?
Global goal and adaptation.
Yeah.
Agriculture maybe.
Yeah.
Definitely difficult to carbon markets.
Yeah.
6.2 for example. Like a lot of people don't even know what they're negotiating.
No.
But the thing is with 6.2 like of 6.8 is, and I'm not trying to like be the like I'm not trying to fetishize it.
Right.
Like, oh yeah, it's going to end all be all.
Yeah, I don't want to be like a hype, but it is a hype. It is a bit of a hype, but...
But you want to show the potential of it.
Yeah.
And it has potential for indigenous peoples to demonstrate.
Yeah.
Not to like talk about the abstracts,
the
statistics, but to demonstrate what you cannot do in agriculture, what you cannot do in adaptation, what you cannot do in GST, for example, this is actually like, all right, how do you do it?
Yeah.
And that is what I think is it could be an exciting thing for indigenous people to start like putting their teeth in for the next couple of months or a year.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, so how do we give this whole thing hands and feet? Yeah. How do we present another definition of a non-market approach that actually falls in line with what countries like Bolivia have said or tried to push for when this was negotiated.
But do you think indigenous people can come up with a definition of this so-called no-market approach?
I think that we shouldn't be trying to come up with a definition.
Okay. Just keep it...
We just show it.
We can show it what is not, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, it's just about showing what we do, how we do it, why we do it.
Yeah.
You know, and then I think a definition will emerge by itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
like you know one when you see one, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you recognize them when you see it. You know, you know, so that's I don't want to like start with definition and then then these people have like, whether my non-market approach falls within the scope of the definition that's been negotiated at the Glasgow Committee on Non-Market Approaches.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, we're just gonna like present, demonstrate what it is that we do and everything else, and then makes it as crystal clear for parties as well as these people. All right, so this is what it's not, what a non-market approach is. So there's no crediting involved, all that stuff.
No trading.
All right, so actually there's principles involved.
Yeah.
The currency is principles.
Yeah.
And not, I don't know, dirham or
carbon
whatever.
Carbon credits. And forest trees.
Yeah. Exactly. And also, so this is what it's not. So that's how you can like scaffold your way towards a definition.
Understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
Understanding of what the concept of non-market approach is.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe we shouldn't even be calling it a non-market approach.
Yeah.
At that point, but
do you regret that we didn't? Well, the Article 16 in general hasn't really engaged with the Article 6.8.
No.
No.
No. No. I get it. Like, because
at the beginning.
Yeah. No. I don't. Like, it's easy to reflect or linger to the road not taken.
Yeah.
You know, should've, would've, could've, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. It's with the information that we have right now, we're able to, and the people, this is not like serendipity, but it's actually, like it had to be this way.
Yeah.
So 6.8 is now we can give it more meat than we did in the beginning.
Tell me how you found out about that workshop and how you organized it, because it wasn't in my radar, at least when we were thinking about Article 6, because because for the last two COPs and even at the beginning of this COP, we always focused on the market mechanism.
Yeah.
But suddenly, I found myself seeing Andrea and you and others engaged in the Article 6.8 workshop. Mm-hmm. So tell me how you got there. Like where did it start?
Actually, I was kind of as frustration.
Yeah.
To be very honest, it was frustration. Sorry. Right. So we have the Article 6 and loss of damage advocacy team, and we're preparing for COP.
Yeah.
And then, like, all of a sudden, like, this just transition position paper came in.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, Article 6 and loss of damage, they're like huge topics, huge monsters.
Yeah.
Like, why in the world would you also saddle us up with a huge monster like just transition?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what to do, but like, it's there needs to be a position paper, and and that's the thing, like, it's, if you're a team lead or whatever, like you try to accommodate.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, all right, let's continue working on the language, and they kept continuing working on the language. I needed to find a place for it.
Mm.
So I looked at the just transition work stream and the just transition text that these people were preparing.
Yeah.
And I looked at it like they're not matching.
Yeah.
Like this what we're advocating for in our position paper on just transition is totally different from the just transition what UNFCCC is looking at right now, which is the workforce.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, if you want to talk about that, go to ILO.
Yeah.
Not to indigenous peoples. Yeah. So I'm like, all right, so what is the right host or monster, if you will, for just transition? So then I can't remember. Oh yeah, so then I walked back to, like, because I had to do a presentation to students at Yale.
Yeah.
about Indigenous people's participation in, in Europe's policy diplomacies, and the way that I teach or explain things is like making using analogies. I went through the analogy that I did for Article 6 and end up at 6.8, like change of lifestyle. And then like the light bulb moment came. Like, oh, hold on, change of lifestyle. And that's pretty much what Just Transition position paper is advocating for. So then I went, I really went through the decision text of 6.8. And then I saw like in one of the preamble paragraphs, like about the Just Transition, like, all right, so there's a hook in there. And then you see like this workshop, and you already know that there's a not necessarily a definition of non-market approach. So opportunity. So that's when I said, all right, hey guys, I think I found something where we can build in elements of just transition in non-market approach and demonstrate it. So not just like, hey, into text and negotiation, but actually show, demonstrate it through presentations and everything else. So that's how, you know, and then people, it's also like, one thing is to have an idea, but also it's like, know how to sell it. And who is like your first adopter, you know, like, all right, who's the first one to adopt it? Like, so, and then, so you talk about it, and then obviously Andrea, like she hopped on it and I was like, sold immediately. And the thing that is what other people are like seeing as well. Like, hey, like we can intervene, we can show, we can demonstrate, and there's no confrontation.
No.
There's no confrontation of like, well, this is outside of scope or whatever. Yeah. No, it's actually, no, this is a non-market approach.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no way that they can counter that.
Yeah.
Because first of all, they have no idea what it means.
You
know, and second of all, the only ones that know what it means are Indigenous people. So like, all right. You know, so it's, I think, I'm not Nostradamus, but like, I think within the next couple of years, you will see that build up towards a non-market approach, knowing what it is, trying to explain what it is not, give it as a comfortable framework so that does not include carbon credit and all that stuff. And then you go into that international cooperation aspect. So if you get that, and then obviously like if you like 30,000 feet view and you look at like how NS participation process is advancing within the UN, you know, the international cooperation part, it can be very exciting. So that's how I try to look at 6.8 in this case.
Then what is your fear? Like, do you have any
that I'm so out of tune with what 6.8 is that I'm that I'm like the Madrid scenario comes
yeah
up. That's my biggest fear. But so far like we're okay, you know, but like my biggest fear is that like that we have the Madrid scenario, like, oh my
but
guys,
you read the text and it's very kind of digestible. No, like it's not very technical what's written in a text.
No, because remember Glasgow, the idea like was to have a definition of it and everything else. But like second week, it got like minimized into what it is right now. It's like Glasgow Committee and non market approaches, website and everything else. So there was an attempt to operationalize it in a way. Didn't succeed. So which is an opportunity, you know. So it's. So the curse is also a blessing in a sense.
Yeah, at least when I read Article 6.8, I feel like it's within the bandwidth of the languages that I understand. You know? A lot about participation.
Yeah, in contradiction to 6.2, right?
Yeah, 6.2, which was like additionality and transfer credits and double counting. We had no idea.
Still don't have an idea.
Yeah, we still don't have any idea. Yeah. But perhaps the reason that perhaps that the Article 6.8 is a little bit more digestible to us, that makes it more kind of relatable to what they're trying to achieve. When you listen to Bolivia's intervention, we get that, we get what they're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And when we listen to other interventions also, like, yeah, we get what they're trying to say. And they always go through the standard of, okay, so who are the stakeholders and human rights, indigenous peoples. That's always been the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at least in a broader kind of context of six non-market approach, there's a sense that, yeah, we get it enough to kind of engage with it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So,
yeah.
Challenge. How should I put it? And this is coming from someone that actually negotiated the platform.
Right.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, could 6.8 potentially be what we actually wanted with the platform?
Well, platform has specific reference to the rights.
Concept, yeah.
Oh. Like specific reference to the rights of indigenous peoples, right?
Yeah.
And
because the name is in it.
Yeah. And the form is very much up to the expectation of what indigenous people want from any body that concerns states and indigenous people. For example, mm-hmm. Equal number of seats, equal leadership position.
Okay. I get that.
And then in Glasgow, it's a very heart of the Paris Agreement. It's like a one game above, right? Like it's Article 6. We're talking about Article 6, and we're talking about a decision that is being fought over at the CMA level, mm-hmm. right? LSEP, SAVSTA, like it all ended in SAVSTA, better or worse.
But
this Glasgow text that we have now, it's gonna go up to CMA.
Right.
And perhaps they'll probably do some emergency operations and may have a completely different text compared to what we are reading right now.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're not sure. And then as you know, the further you go into the COP and then work to Indigenous peoples, civil society will start to lose their position, lose their seat or mm-hmm. position
yeah.
in the negotiation.
Okay.
So the capacity to engage at this point is probably not the same as what the LSIP was. LSIP negotiation unfolded, and as a result, it's very difficult to know what might come in the end. But you know, answering your question about like. Is no market mechanism, is this Glasgow committee, right? Or whatever that might come out in the end,
mm-hmm.
is that more ideal than ideal avenue for indigenous peoples to share knowledge and climate policy action and capacity building and all that, than LSEP? To be honest, I don't know.
Right.
I think that would be my answer. I don't know. But what I do know is that this time, like certain corners of indigenous caucus is into it. Like it's, you know, it's 6.8 is they're seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if more people understood, you know, what 6.8 could mean, and it's something that has to be explained as well. Okay, what is the difference between 6.8 and LSIP? Somewhere down the road, it has to be explained, mm-hmm. I imagine. But learning from the experience of LSIP and its shortcomings and strength, I think indigenous people will still have the opportunity to make something better
mm-hmm.
for this no-market mechanism.
Okay.
Because at one point, I was concerned that maybe indigenous people will get trapped in the LSIP. Right. This is like all the indigenous people go there.
Like a catch-all bucket for these people.
Catch-all bucket.
Is that the case right now?
Well, I mean, the way the UNFCCC kind of refers to indigenous people is LSEP, right? So like if you want to talk to indigenous people, go to the LSEP. But
right.
you know, facilitated working group is not really representative of indigenous peoples. It's representative of indigenous peoples in states, and needs to have the caucus.
Yeah.
So I think the Glasgow, if a lot of indigenous people go there. Then like, hang on a minute. I thought the LSEP was a catch-all thing. I thought if you want to talk to indigenous people, go to the LSEP. But now you have the
right.
Glasgow Committee or no market approach, and you have the caucus. So there's more present. Like you're trying to be engaged and present and participating and creating, you know, new avenues to make sure that the parties know that indigenous people can participate in different forms is important. Yeah.
Right. Good view. The way that I start to I like to see it is that the LC becomes a feature of 6.8.
Okay. So like.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, like a feature of 6.8. So. Yeah. For example, you had the knowledge sharing exercise of the platform. Yeah. You know, like, all right, cool. However, like that could be like a feature of the...
That could be an activity of the...
Of the non-market approach as well. You know, it interacts with one another. Yeah. So it's... I'm not saying that it should the one should replace the other, but I think definitely it's... If states fail at this point to see the efficacy, or not efficacy, but the how should I get so-called, like the function of the LSIP in relation to the agenda.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the three function of the platform, but the relation to the agenda, this could be it.
Yeah.
This could be like one of the, so this could be like one, oh, hold on. If it works like this on non-market approaches, let's do something on our agriculture.
Yeah.
Let's do something like, and then you could, so as Article 6 is the first through the door for carbon markets, how about 6.8 being the first through the door in terms of streamlining indigenous people's knowledge and participation?
Yeah. And it has a semi-permanent mandate, right? Article 6.8.
Yeah.
Paris Agreement is a mandate that will continue to that is there until we achieve the goal of, you know, 1.5. So it's within. So indigenous people have been positioned in a better place to contribute.
You position yourself.
Yeah.
Because neither parties nor indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
In the beginning, did not see like the added value.
Yeah.
However, instead of like, that's what I see. That's what I mean. Like, it's instead of like, oh, platform. This is our place.
Yeah.
No, you look at all these streams. Like, so how can I bend it in such a way that it could actually benefit the objective that we have over here at the NFCCC?
Yeah.
So like, it's all right. Non-market approaches, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, we can use it as an avenue too.
Yeah.
And you expand it, you build it, and that can become a model for further things to be done.
My friends, I hope you enjoyed this. Please consider to subscribe, to comment, and to share this video on your socials.